It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to the 48th episode of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. I think you're going to enjoy my interview with J.T. Krull, writer of many great comics, including Teen Titans, Green Arrow, the upcoming Superman Beyond series, and the Batman Beyond Unlimited comic, as well as many other good comics. He has a lot of interesting things to say, so I know you'll enjoy listening to our conversation. Then I review this week's comics, followed by my monthly visit with Pete Casaza from Big Planet Comics in College Park, Maryland. Then we wrap everything up with my usual cohorts, Gianluca Glazer and Ian Cullen, talking about this week's news and previews. We've got a lot to get to, so let's get to it. Talking today with J.T. Krull, a great writer who's done things that I really enjoyed, including many versions of Green Arrow, Teen Titans, Batman, the Joker's Asylum series with Poison Ivy, got many things in the New 52 going on, including Captain Atom and the upcoming Superman Beyond series. How are you doing today, J.T.?
Doing great, man. Thanks for having me.
Oh, great. It's good to have you on. I always like to ask people, how did you get started reading comics, and then how did you get started actually working on them?
I was just a little boy, and my uncle, I had an older uncle that we would visit from time to time when he was still living with my grandmother when he was still in college, and he had a box of comic books in his room that I stumbled upon one day. It had some Superman in it, some Batman, some Green Lantern, and it had issue 132 of Uncanny X-Men, and that was pretty much the first comic I remember reading and absorbing what I was reading, because a lot of times when you find them when you're really young, like flashes in the pan, and it's like, oh, Superman's here, and then there's Captain America or whatever, and it's just all kind of a jumbled mess of memories. But that was the first comic that I remember. It was funny, when I first actually read it, like I actually thought the Hellfire, it was in the issue, the Hellfire Club defeats the X-Men. And even though it said it on the cover, I was still young enough that for some reason I thought Sebastian Shaw was the leader of the X-Men and the X-Men were the villains. So, and it was such a good time to be exposed to comics, especially the X-Men, because that was one of the definitive, if not the most definitive run in all of the X-Men lore. Mm-hmm. So I read that a little bit, and then I was probably about 8 or 9. I found the spindle rack at a liquor store in my hometown of Hastings, a small town of about 6,000 people. So this was back in the days there weren't comic book shops really, and so it was basically the spindle rack. I found the X-Men, and I found Daredevil, Alpha Flight. It was more of a Marvel spindle rack. I was introduced to Marvel a little earlier than I was to the DC world, as far as initial offerings in Spider-Man, of course, and then, you know, expanded on to like Batman and Green Lantern and Superman and the like. But that was my first foray into comics.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you, I got to clarify something. You said the rack was in a liquor store?
Yeah, technically they had other stuff. It wasn't just a liquor store. They had other stuff, but it was like a party store, you know?
Oh, so, okay.
I mean, definitely it was, booze was definitely their primary goal, but it wasn't like I was breaking the law by entering there. It was just, it happened to be between my house and the school when I walked to school. But I remember like going in every day, and then it got to the point where I would find spindle racks in other stores. And I just remember one time I found a spindle rack in a bookstore and got new comics and stuff because I was taking a road trip with my dad. And that day we were driving down to Ohio. And in Ohio, I found my very first comic store, like my, you know, LCS. And it just blew my mind because not only was it just comics wall to wall, but I walked in there. And because at that time I was so young enough, I didn't know about the delay between direct marketing and the spindle rack. So I literally got these comics for the ride down, read them on the ride down, went to the comic store the next day and found the next issues on the stand. And I was like, oh my God, like it's the future. They've got the next issues already out there. So that was knee deep. And like, it was West Coast Avengers was just launching their ongoing. And I was a huge fan of Squadron Supreme, and the miniseries was going on right at then. So it was just good times.
It makes me smile because you reminded me there's a store that I went to that was the strangest comic store I ever was in. They sold women's shoes, they did car window tinting, and then they sold comics. And so I assumed no matter who you were, you could get something. I just found that a really funny store to go to.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and that is always the funny thing. I mean, it normally gets associated with collectibles. Like, you know, like I remember a shop that did baseball cards, obviously. I mean, that's not really out of center. But there was one that was called Kibbe Coins. They did rare coins and jewelry and watches and comic books. So... You know, and that was like one of my shops that I went to for a long time. So, but yeah, you're right. I just kind of, I mean, the window tinting and ladies' shoes, that's the new one. That's definitely Walmart. You know, it's like the early beginnings of Walmart are there somewhere. The genesis for Walmart is there.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. Now, okay, so you read comics for a long time. How did you actually start to work on them and you write for them?
Well, I've been wanting to be a writer pretty much my whole life, and I've written since I was a kid. And I went to Michigan State and studied telecommunications, film and video production, and then moved to California. And I was writing spec screenplays and spec drama and comedy spec scripts, trying to get into television and film. And I got a contact, kind of a liaison from Marvel, a guy named Josh Ryan, who's actually a writer now in his own right. He does this book at Archaea called Syndrome. This was a small window when Marvel was actually looking for people. And this was before like all the entertainment people jumped into comic books, where you had this carryover, where you had television and film people that were fans of comic books that have decided that they have kind of entered the comic book world, and like Damon Lillianoff doing the Ultimate Hulk versus Wolverine type thing. Like, it was kind of before all that started. That was just the beginning of that. So it wasn't as commonplace as it is now. And so Marvel is actually looking for entertainment people to do stuff. So they're accepting submissions and stuff. So through a friend of mine, I got in touch with Josh Ryan, and I just started writing sample scripts. They were looking to relaunch the Unlimited line, X-Men Unlimited and Spider-Man Unlimited. And at the time, they were also talking about an Avengers Unlimited possibly as well. So I just wrote scripts. I wrote like, I don't know, I probably wrote and submitted like 5 11-page scripts. And they bought one. They bought a Halloween-themed X-Men story I did that featured the younger student mutants, but also featured Cyclops and Jean Grey and Beast. So that was my very first comic book story that I sold. That came out right at the beginning of 2004. I was actually very lucky, and I got into X-Men Unlimited #1. So I did that, and then right around the same time that I was writing that story, they asked me if I wanted to do something for Spider-Man. So I wrote a Spider-Man Unlimited story that ended up in being an issue 2 of that. So right away, like 2 months in a row, I had a story in each of the books. And it was great because it just gave me that extra bit of validation when meeting with people. And it was right around the time that those books came out that I met with Michael Turner and Frank Mastromauro over at Aspen. Not only was I able to talk to them about writing, but I was able to show them published comic book work, which helped immensely in me being able to get the opportunity to work with them on their Fathom line.
Great. Now, of course, you started with 2 of the biggest Marvel properties there are, X-Men and Spider-Man. Not a bad way to start.
Yeah, you know, it was pretty cool. If we would have done the other ones too. I wrote like an Angel story I really liked, and I did a Beast story, and I did a Wolverine and Jean Grey one that I really liked. And then I think I wrote an Avengers short one, but none of those got published. So it was just those two. The talk was that I was going to start doing more stuff with them, but it just turned out that the editors I worked with that I had starting to get to know, like, I think there was something about me, because like it seemed like every time I started working with an editor there, they left to go do something else. And so I literally got... And when I sold the Spider-Man story, the editor, they were like, oh, I'm going to hand you off to so-and-so because I'm leaving. And then it was Mark Shimerak was the guy that I got handed off to. And then during that story, that 3-week period, he's like, I just want to let you know so-and-so is going to come in and finish up because I'm actually going to be pulling away and doing up blah, blah, blah. So I was like, all of a sudden, I was like, any editor that I got to know and got to be on a, you know, first name basis with and start, you know, talking about doing more things, they left to explore other avenues. And so then I started working with Aspen, and Aspen had a ton of work for me, and I started doing that. And then because Aspen and DC has such a good relationship, like I got to know the guys at DC a little bit, and that's kind of how it all just kind of snowballed from there. So
cool. Now, as you were kind enough to do a written Q&A with me about a year ago at scifipulse.net, where I still write, one of the questions that I asked kind of dovetails in what you were saying about film. You answered a question where you were saying that it's not required to have a film background, but you think it's helpful to write comics if you have that.
Yeah, I think because comic books is a visual medium as well, it's just like film. And I kind of liken it to where in film, you want to focus on the moments of the story, the beats of the story, the moments of the story that are going to have the most impact, that mean the most to the story you're trying to tell. And it works the same way in comic books, but in comic books, it's even a little trickier because you have to talk about those iconic images, because in comic books, you don't have motion, so everything's static. So where you have to really pick and choose, like, what are the most important images for you to kind of lock on to, you know. And it took me a while as I was writing it, where I'd want to, like, I would write a story and I would have a scene and just the panel would break down, and it would be very methodical, but it would also be honestly a lot of dead space in terms of comic book spacing and what you need. Like if you're having a character getting up to go across the room, when I first started writing one, I might say, oh, you know, the character's sitting in a chair, panel two, the character's standing up. Panel three, the character's walking across the room. Panel four, the character's leaving the room. Well, you know, now knowing what I know, I would definitely not like form the script that way unless for some specific reason there was a point to it, because you want to just pick the biggest beat. So you might have him sitting down and then walking to leave the room. You wouldn't necessarily have to get all those little points in between. Almost like I'd imagine like when you storyboard animation would probably be a similar way where you're just kind of taking like the biggest points of it. So in that regard, I think that script writing actually helps because you're setting a scene and letting the story kind of play out and dealing with dialogue and all that sort of stuff. And the format to writing a script is very similar to writing a screenplay, except in a screenplay, you're breaking down like a setting and then it's the action and the dialogue. Whereas in a comic book, like you're describing each of the panels and kind of dissecting it to another level. So, and there's such a cinematic quality to comic books, especially in today's day and age. I mean, the influence of movie making in comic books is so prevalent. I mean, even with just things like the abundance of widescreen, if you want to call it widescreen paneling in comic books, where you have a page will be a series of five panels all the way across the page, as opposed to more traditional comic books and where we came from in the traditional comic book field, where you'd have the grid of eight panels or six panels where there'd be more square panels, and that, you know, we've kind of gotten away from that and want that almost letterbox format as opposed to the pan and scan type stuff that you might have seen earlier.
It's just funny to me because it seems that a lot of comic books are, to me, a lot of debuts. It's almost like comics writers and artists are saying, this is how you could turn this into a movie. It's much more of a cinematic feel than it used to have.
Well, I mean, and that's absolutely true. And you're more right than it's not even just something in terms of like a stylistic thing. I mean, the honest truth is that comic books and independent comic books have really become a showcase for new concepts and new ideas, specifically for people to get them in front of developers and producers and whatnot and creative executives in the film and television industry to kind of show them what it would be like. I mean, you're essentially giving them a storyboarded version of this story. And say you have a development executive or producer and they've got a stack of screenplays. I mean, those are 100, 120 pages of white paper with black type. And if you can hand them a visual story that really just sells the story and tells the story and conveys the story in a much more powerful and dramatic fashion, it's going to stand out a lot more. And in the same respect, you draw a comic book, and if you're doing a comic book and you've got a main male character lead who's the hero of your story, and he's drawn in a very appealing and powerful and dominating way, it's going to appeal to actors that may look at it. And if Thomas Jane reads a script about the Punisher, like he's like, yeah, that's pretty cool. But if he sees a Punisher comic book, then it's like those images, I think, psychologically have a much bigger impact, and they can look at it and be like, yeah, he's badass. Like, I want to be that guy. I want to play that guy.
Or Samuel L. Jackson looks like Nick Fury for some reason.
Right. And you're seeing that a lot too. I mean, and a lot of times, even writers, they'll tailor, and writers and artists, or writers working with artists, or just artists, or whatever, like, they'll tailor a character to look like somebody. You know, it might even, and I've even done it in the past, when developing characters, you know, I will talk to the artist and say, well, this is what this character's like. And I might throw out a couple of examples of a character that I think that reminds me, like, for instance, I did a lot of this with my book Minefield at Aspen, and the Connor character, I kind of saw him as a little bit kind of a James McAvoy kind of character, you know. So I use that as a reference, and I threw in a couple other references to him. The thing I like about James McAvoy is chiseled abs in Wanted aside, he's a very regular, not meek, but he's very average in terms of his presence, if you will. You know, he doesn't come across as a physically dominating presence, and that's what I wanted the character to be. I didn't want the character to be, he wasn't your typical alpha male. You know, it's not Hugh Jackman, it's something along the lines of something else. So you kind of play that up when you're writing, so it kind of lends itself to it, because the movies are our biggest points of reference that we can do, especially when you're working with artists across the country or artists that you don't know as well, or especially international artists. You're trying to convey a point in a script and you're trying to plan a scene. And if you can say like, oh, you know, it kind of reminds me in terms of theme, something along the lines of the scene from Lord of the Rings. Well, chances are if they're working in comic books, they've seen Lord of the Rings, and you can have that connection where it gives you a nice launching point. It just kind of helps paint the scene and they know what you're kind of looking for.
Mm-hmm. Let's move into the Joker's Asylum. You did a Poison Ivy one-shot as part of that for DC. And since I'm a Batman guy, I always want to talk about the Batman stuff. What was it like to write Poison Ivy and to do something that was part of the Joker and the Batman mythology?
It was great. The honest truth is, Batman is probably the greatest comic book character in existence. And part of the reason that is because his rogues galleries are so just, it's fantastic. No one has a cast of villains like he does. Your Joker and your Two-Face and your Penguin and your Mr. Freeze and your Poison Ivy, you know, it's just, and the list goes on, and Bane and Hugo Strange. And it's just amazing the depth of that cast, of that roster of villains that it can tap into. So I was very thankful that Mike March was the editor, that he was actually the one who got me my first break at DC Comics. He hired me for, I did a JSA Classified 2-issue story about Dr. Midnight with him. And so that was my first time working with DC, and that was working with Mike. And so he gave me my first break at DC. And so when he called me about the Poison Ivy story, it was easy. And there were a couple ones that were available, and I was like, yeah, I'd really like to do the Poison Ivy one. Because for me, especially when you're doing a story like this where it's focused on the villains, it was really important to tell a story where you can kind of see their point of view, where it's that mantra of everybody's the hero of their own story. You know, villains don't see themselves as villains type thing. And so, you know, really trying to kind of hammer that home, especially what's going on. And also the Poison Ivy's a great character, and being able to write Batman for one of my first DC books, and also being able to include the Joker in it, and that Crypt Keeper kind of host, kind of where he's the storyteller kind of thing with the little tag and the opening and the tag scene for him. It was just a lot of fun. And Gillian March did a fantastic job in the art, and he's gone on to do some just more incredible work at DC. So it was just a blast. I mean, it was so much fun to be, and to be part of that, just that ensemble of people working on that first volume of the Joker's Asylum book. I thought the Jason Pearson, I thought the Penguin story in that one was probably one of my favorites. I think Jason Aaron wrote it, actually. And it was probably my favorite of the ones of that in the group that I was in. I just, because the Penguin, I think, is one of the harder ones to come across, is to really make him kind of cool and really kind of get into his head. And I thought he did a really good job of making him creepy and powerful and menacing, but yet still kind of holding true to what the character's about.
Yeah, I agree. The Penguin is the toughest, I think, of the Batman mythology to do. Now, you started doing Green Arrow, and you have an interesting history with Green Arrow. You've written several different versions of Green Arrow, it seems like. You started out with the Arsenal storyline, and then you moved into Green Arrow, which I really loved the whole, I think for a year you did this where he was in like Sherwood Forest as a Robin Hood kind of character.
Yeah, the Brightest Day run, yeah.
Yeah, that was great. I loved that, because one of the things you do, and I really enjoy, is that you don't necessarily take people down the superheroic route, and I put that in quotes, because once people have a costume on, they all seem to behave somewhat the same. But when you do stuff, I think with like Captain Atom and with Green Arrow and all these people, they don't necessarily act like standard superhero people. They act like real human beings in an odd situation. I really like that.
No, thanks. It's a matter of the flaws in humanity. You know, I mean, that's what draws me to somebody like Oliver Queen, who's one of the best characters to write for. I mean, every character's got their flaws, but Ollie really wears his on his sleeve. And as you have the character like Green Arrow, and when Oliver Queen is Green Arrow, like, he always seems to manage to do the right thing. It was just, as Oliver Queen, he was kind of a screw up. Like, he made mistakes and he was always kind of messing things up and being absent for Roy when he needed him the most, about the whole heroin thing and the great classic story, the Neil Adams, Daniel O'Neill stuff. And his tumultuous relationship with Dinah and all that. But once he puts on the mask, he never backs down from anything. And to have a guy who uses arrows interacting with the likes of Superman and Green Lantern and Wonder Woman, you know, in the Justice League, like, it's just to kind of have the balls to still throw yourself into the fray when you have that all going on, it's a testament to his sense of character. Being brave is about throwing yourself into the situation even when you know the outcome might not be good. You know, I mean, that's the sign of true courage. So dealing with those flaws in Oliver Queen and being able to go through the fall of Green Arrow, and the Brightest Day one was all about him redeeming himself as a hero in his own eyes, because he had just failed everybody. He failed himself in killing Prometheus. He failed himself in keeping it from everybody. He failed Dinah. He pushed everybody away from him. He pushed himself away from Mia. He failed Roy. Dinah left them. Green Lantern, Hal, and him, you know, they had their moment, because he basically betrayed everything that the Justice League was about. He betrayed and he lied to everybody close to him, and so he kind of forced himself into a self-exile. And that's what that story was about, is that he didn't feel like he deserved to be a hero, but he still walked that path. He just didn't see himself that way. It was always like he was atoning. No matter what he did, he was always going to be atoning for what he'd done wrong in the past. And so that's why you have a character like Galahad played a central role thematically coming into the story. It's because he was that vision for him. And here was a guy who saw himself as that knight and was doing all the right things. And was kind of like a little bit of a beacon for Oliver Queen to emulate, if you will. Even though he was already there, it was just a matter of, again, trying to forgive himself and have that little bit of rebirth or renaissance where he can have a cleansing moment and come away and be the hero again.
Right. I want to get back to Green Arrow, but before I do that, I want to talk a little bit about Teen Titans, which was great fun, too. I loved your Teen Titans. When I wrote to you and you were writing, answering my questions, I talked about all the history of the Teen Titans, and you have to go through and pick all the stuff out. And I thought you did a great job of cherry-picking the characters. And then in the process, you created a new Titan yourself. That was Solstice. Do you want to talk about what motivated you to make her or create her as a character?
Well, we wanted to create a new character and bring her in. And for me, bringing another minority character into the fold was definitely something that I was interested in. And another girl, because it was getting to be a little bit of a boys' club. You had Raven and Wonder Girl, but then it was Superboy and Robin and Beast Boy and whatnot. So the scales were tipped a little bit. But the real thing with Solstice for me was when I took over the book, it was really important for me that I wanted to focus on family, because that's what the book is all about. The book is all about the notion of being a family. And I think sometimes too much attention is given to the dysfunctional aspects of being a family, especially with the Teen Titans. I mean, I get it, because they're teenagers, they're all going through what they're doing, but like, it's kind of like when you're watching television and the characters are always fighting about something, and it's almost always about miscommunication, and you're like, if you just got that email or listened to their voicemail message or would shut up for 3 seconds and listen to what they said, you guys realize that you really aren't mad at each other. It's just a stupid misunderstanding. And that perpetuates. But I get it. You know, conflict and drama like that all is important. But what I want to do is create a different type of conflict and a different type of drama. So the earlier cast, it made sense for like what Felicia was doing and before then, because when you had characters like Bombshell and Miss Martian and whatnot, they were characters who didn't necessarily, like, I never understood why they were there. Like, none of them seemed like they wanted to be together, but they were together. They weren't forced to be there. Like, Bombshell, nothing was keeping Bombshell with the Teen Titans. She just chose to be there and just be kind of a pain in the ass to everybody and mouth off to everybody and just be difficult. So for me, part of the reason about getting back to what I call the A-listers in terms of the Teen Titans world was because I also wanted to bring back the people who were truly there because they wanted to be there and have that sense of family. And so, and getting back to the Solstice aspect, I really wanted to bring in somebody who had a more positive view of the world and a positive view of life and what was happening and everything, and just viewed the world in a different way, because all the Teen Titans have such a just a terribly depressing and tragic past. You know, Beast Boy and what he went through, it's, you know, it's like, I don't know if I referenced this specifically in a script, but I actually had this idea for they were going to sit around. It was basically they were going to sit around and say, who's got the shittiest parents? You know, because you have Ravager, you have Rose Wilson, whose dad is Deathstroke, so that explains it all. Raven's dad is Demon, Trigon. You have Tim Drake's father's dead. You could argue because of what he was involved in. Superboy was born in a test tube. Wonder Girl's dad is Zeus and just totally checked out. Like, none of them have positive support systems. Helena in Wonder Girl's, I mean, they had people there, but like, not in terms of like the mentor figures. Like, yeah, they, you know, Superboy has Superman and Robin has Batman, and you have that, but it's a little different. In the same way the Teen Titans wanted to kind of carve their own path, that's why you couldn't really use them. But Solstice, for me, I wanted to have it be somebody who had, she had positive role models in her parents. She had a positive view of the world. She was a very international person in scope. She'd been around the world. She'd seen a lot. She's multicultural. She is interested in and sees the wonders of the world around her. And to be able to bring that, and also played off nicely against Raven into being kind of the anti-Raven, where for Raven, emotions were a dangerous thing that she was afraid of, where Solstice was all about absorbing the emotion. And I think I even had a scene in one of the issues where they were back at Titan's Tower, and Raven is on one level, and she's meditating, trying to shut everything out. And a couple levels below, you have Solstice, and she's meditating, but more of an open capacity, and she's basically allowing all the energy of an emotion of life to come into her. And Raven was really jealous of her for that aspect. You know, it was actually something that, had the book been able to go on in the incarnation that I was doing, it was something I was going to explore as they had this difficult relationship, because Raven was very jealous of Solstice and how she could do that and how people were around her because of that, because of somebody who was charismatic and engaging and bright, and everybody wanted to be around her and everybody liked her and she had a positive energy. Just like we've all met people in our lives that were just like, they were just very charismatic people, and they brought out the best in you, and you wanted to be around them, you wanted to hang out with them, and they were always the center of attention, the life of the party, but not in any egotistical way. It would just kind of happen to be. They were just a joy to be around, and people wanted to be around them. And that's how I always saw Solstice.
That's really cool. Of course, this dovetails perfectly. What prevented that from going forward was the New 52. And one of the cool things I saw when I was looking at the Teen Titans, I was so happy when I saw that Solstice was going to be in the New 52. What was your reaction when you found out? Because you weren't going to be involved with the Teen Titans anymore. What was it like when you found out Solstice was going to continue on?
I mean, it was great. I mean, I was bummed because I wasn't going to be the one writing her anymore. But beside that, it was great because we devoted a lot of time to introducing her. And we had, you know, the whole storyline was like a 5-issue storyline introducing her, and really was a showcase to kind of bring Solstice on the thing. thing. And once that storyline was done, we had three more issues left. And so it would have really been sad if after those three issues, if Solstice just got erased from the DC Universe altogether and we just never saw her. So when Scott told me he wanted to use her and they had plans for her, I was pretty happy about it. I was glad she wasn't going to wind up on the cutting room floor, so to speak. So.
Well, she was your child, and she was moving off into other folks and working with them instead. So it's always sad to see the children go off and do other things.
Right.
That, of course, brings us into the New 52, and there's a lot to talk about. And I always want to congratulate anybody from DC that I talked to, because I just thought the New 52 was this great earthquake that just changed the whole landscape of the comics industry. And I just want to congratulate you and everybody else that was involved with it, because I'm so happy. I've bought all the issues. I've kept up with everything of it, and I love it all. And I've been reading comics for decades, and I'm used to change, I guess, more than some people are. But I thought Captain Atom was a great book. I thought Green Arrow was great fun. And I just want to talk with you a little bit about the creation of those characters. The Green Arrow book, now you only got to stay on it a little while before you started to go off and do something else. My understanding is we'll get to that book in a couple minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But when you got the chance to be involved in the New 52, did you propose what you wanted to do with Captain Atom and Green Arrow? How did this whole system work as far as your involvement with it?
With the Green Arrow, it was a part of a larger conversation. I mean, they had things they wanted to accomplish with the New 52 in terms of isolating the core concept of the characters and really just kind of returning them to the roots and going forward, not just with Green Arrow or Captain Atom, but in all their titles. Green Arrow was a little bit trickier because of the younger persona, if you will, the younger version of Oliver Queen and making him a younger. It did pull away from a lot of the stuff we'd been doing. And so there was kind of a bigger shift in his character. Is almost like Green Arrow the early years or whatever, you know. So we were kind of dialing it back a little bit. So that was a little jarring, because a lot of the stuff I'd been developing in the Brightest Day run, like we moved in a severely different direction. And so that was a shift, not only in the terms of character, but also in terms of the tone of the book. He went from the tortured hero using regular arrows in the forest and protecting a city to more of a global James Bond, Bourne Identity, Mission Impossible character who went up against huge threats and used high-tech arrows and other high-tech devices and had this support system that he worked with and running his company, Q-Corps. So that was a big shift. And when it came time and I had to choose between sticking with one or the other, between Green Arrow and Captain Atom, I think part of the reason why I chose Captain Atom was because of what I was doing with Captain Atom and how jazzed I was about it. But also because I like the new Green Arrow and I like everything that they were doing. It's for me as a writer in terms of what I'm best at and what I was going to be able to bring to the table. Like, I just felt like it was going in a direction that I could do it for a while. I couldn't see me doing that book that way for 15, 20 issues. Like, I just kind of saw that, like, you know, it was great being able to re-steer the ship into a new direction and kind of set everything up and let everybody else kind of play with it. So in Green Arrow, there was a little bit more of a seismic shift. Captain Atom, it was a little easier because I wasn't writing Captain Atom before. And also because even though Captain Atom's appeared in a lot of books, he's not as much on the forefront with readers as, say, a Green Arrow or you know, other characters who've had their own books. I mean, it actually had been a while since Captain Atom even had his own book. He was definitely a player in Generations Lost, which was a great book that Judd Winnick wrote. That was one of my favorite Brightest Day books. But other than that, you know, he had the backup in the, I think it was the Action Comics or Superman Comics, he had a backup feature that he did when they did the co-features. But other than that, he's been off the grid a little bit. Mm-hmm. And with that, they call me up. I'm actually pitched to do another book that they'd end up going with. But because of the tone and because of that pitch, and it had a kind of a strong kind of sci-fi element to it, that's, I think, why they came to me and asked me about Captain Atom. And they mentioned Dr. Manhattan and trying to see about, you know, let's do a character along that lines in terms of that power set. Wanted to kind of go in that direction a little bit. And so I was like, okay. And that was really all the direction I got. And then I got partnered up with Freddie Williams very quickly. And we actually worked very closely together to develop the book and what it was going to be, and then pitched it to Rachel and Mike. And they were on board from day one. And I have to say that I'm really happy that they've really just kind of let us tell the story we want to tell. And everything we talked about in that first conversation and everything Freddie and I put together in our first initial pitch, it's all stuff that we're doing. All the big beats, all the big stuff, like, it's all happening exactly as we had planned it. And it's a very fulfilling project for me to work on. It's a very different type of book for me and different type of book in comic books in the DC universe. It's a very character-driven science fiction story about a man struggling with these amazing powers as opposed to being a, quote, superhero book.
See, the irony of this just kills me. Captain Atom was originally supposed to be in The Watchmen, but because Dick Giordano didn't want to have those characters changed or turned into a way that they couldn't use him any longer, Alan Moore created Dr. Manhattan, and now suddenly Captain Atom is going back to being Dr. Manhattan, who was originally Captain Atom. The irony of that just kills me, I have to say.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, when we first started doing it, you know, it was the thing, it was like, that was the whole notion, and then that was the big challenge, is how do you do a book about a character who's got the powers of God? basically. Like, what is that story about, and what kind of stories can you tell? And right off the bat for me, it was a matter of, that's why it has to be different stories. In the Captain Atom mythology, like, there's a character, Major Force, who is the counterpoint to him, his nemesis, if you will. He's the guy who went through the same experiment as Captain Atom, but yet he works, and he's all gung-ho to work for the government, and he kind of goes up, and, you know, he's his big nemesis and has the same power set. And I was like, well, we can't do that, because then it's just like a villain and a hero, and you have that whole thing. And that was actually part of the reason why, for this first arc, the strange creature evolving in the shadows that we finally see, we finally realize what it is. And in issue 6 that just came out last week is this rat who was exposed to the same quantum field and the same experiment that Captain Atom went through. And so it's this notion of, so we are kind of doing it, but doing it in a very different way. And for Captain Atom, the thing that made it click for me was, and the reason is why he's different from Dr. Manhattan, because Dr. Manhattan's a scientist. Like, he understands the concept, he understands all this stuff. So he gets much more detached from humanity much quicker. And where is Nathaniel, he's an Air Force pilot. He's just a man, you know, he's not a lot different from you and me. And he just wants to keep connected to humanity, but everything about who he is and what he's become, it just serves to alienate him and isolate him. You know, and in the book, he talks about humanity in the third person as though he's not part of it anymore, even though that's what he wants more than anything, is just to kind of be able to have that regular life again.
Mm-hmm. I saw you at New York when I think you were there, and you were talking about Captain Atom. And one of the things that you guys were doing, as far as the book goes, was doing something different artistically, in the sense that Captain Atom, when he appears, doesn't seem to have a lot of black ink involved with him. He's much more color reds and blues and brighter colors. And yet the world around him is standard sort of blacks and things like that. That's one of the things about the book that I really like, is that even visually, it's a different story than we're used to. Did the two of you kind of come up with that? How did that work?
That was Freddie's idea. That was all Freddie's idea. And it just worked perfectly. Basically, what you're exactly right, and it's exactly what he does, is Freddie works digitally, and basically Captain Atom is ink washed, so there's no inks on the Captain Atom, but everything else has inks to it. So when you see Captain Atom pages, so when Captain Atom's there, or Captain Atom uses his powers, any of those facets, those, there's no inking on that. It's just ink wash. And so everything else is, he's got the heavier lines, and it's just very distinctive to do that and to put him in and have these kind of darker surroundings for him. So again, thematically, it all just holds. He stands out. He seems alien. He seems isolated. He doesn't even fit in with the environment around him. He's got that kind of ghostly aura presence about him, and he's always, you know, and with the way Jose Villarubia colors it, it's amazing. The bright blues, I was really blown away. I think the third issue is still one of my favorites in terms of just the way the book looks. Like, having the way Captain Atom is with his blues and purple play off against the Flash reds and yellows, it works so well, and it's such a beautiful issue, such a beautiful book.
See, one of the things about the New 52 that I really enjoy is that you all take chances. I mean, this is a chancy thing to do, to change the art of a comic. Batman number 5, Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo have the book turning completely upside down as you're trying to read it. All these kinds of great creative things going on. The Flash, of course, the artwork is very different. You guys are telling stories and doing things and challenging the reader, which I really love as a reader. There's nothing better for me than to pick up a book that I can't wait to read and see what you guys are going to do next, because I just don't have any idea. I love that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think Freddie does an amazing job to lay out, and we're actually doing stuff in the next arc coming up where we're kind of dealing with the whole time displacement thing, and he's going to come face to face with a future version of himself, and then it's a very wild adventure that we really play with the visual medium and play with kind of jumping around, and just, it's a very big story thematically, but also visually it's just very bold. But you're exactly right. I mean, the stuff that Greg's doing on Batman and Francis on Flash, and also J.H. Williams on Batwoman, I think just the way that a lot of artists now are really thinking outside the box in terms of the way they present the stuff on the given page. And like, just in terms of the layouts alone, the way they're doing things, it's just going to another level. And I think there's a ton of artists who've done it and have been working, doing great work over the years. But I really think J.H. Williams' work, when he was doing Detective, that book just, I think, really just raised the bar and really just kind of showed what you could do and not just have to be kind of stuck in those white screen paneling straight down the page and thinking about the page as a full work of art as opposed to a succession of panels and a way to kind of play with things. So I think it's just, like, whenever I work with a new artist and we talk about stuff, I'm very quick to point out stuff like J.H. Williams' stuff, because I just think he's a very talented artist for people to look at. Just in terms of, like, to get ideas about thinking outside the box, he had this amazing double-page spread in Detective Comics where Batwoman was fighting someone on a helicopter, and, like, I can't remember if in the fight, they both fell out of the helicopter, or she did, or the other person did, but the helicopter was on the top left of the double spread, and the panels of them falling out of the plane were panels that fell across the page.
Yeah,
and it's just,
yeah.
it just It's just amazing.
Well, I have to tell you that choosing a rat to be the opposite number for Captain Atom in that book as opposed to Major Force, that surprised me. I thought that was a cool surprise. When I found out it was actually a rat that he was up against, I sat there and said, now how's he going to fight an animal as opposed to a human being that he could try to reason with? So I thought that was really cool. I really liked that.
Thanks. Everything we have in the book, it all is part of this bigger story. What he's going through with the rat, he's been talking and thinking about and worrying about the monster that he could become with the powers. And so, of course, he's facing a monstrous version of himself. He's got to confront that. But like the time code that we introduced early on, we knew the time code early on wasn't going to be something that was going to be in the forefront of what we were doing in terms of the numbers. It was all put in there at the beginning, basically as a device to try to introduce so that when we get to issue 7 and beyond, as we start dealing with this time stuff, issue 7, it jumps around a lot because it's a little bit of an origin issue. It includes about how he got the way he is and how the accident and explores that a little bit. But it's really more about these glimpses of his life before he became Captain Atom and what he misses or what rings in his head kind of thing as he's dealing with all this other stuff going on. So the time code thing like was put in early, even though we really were only going to use it, you know, heavily in this arc coming up. Stuff like Mikey getting cure of cancer, the volcano in issue 1, you know, the fact that he can see the radio signals, the Libyan desert with the glass thing, Renita's hand, all these things, there's a bigger story here and a bigger purpose that in this next arc, it's all going to, you're going to see it all come back and all play a part in what's going on in his story. And that's been the coolest thing to build. Being able to lay those little seeds and plant those seeds and then have them pay off down the road, I think is one of the great joys of being a writer.
See, one of the things I enjoyed about the timestamp that you're doing is that tells me you know where you're going, and we don't necessarily have to have that all resolved within this issue. You've got plans that are going to go even beyond this issue, and when you communicate to me that I know where I'm going, that always makes me feel good, and I can really enjoy the story because I can sit back and let you drive because you know where you're heading, and I like that.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, it's like I said, having that master plan down and being able to play with the pieces and, again, those plant those little Easter eggs or those little seeds and knowing that they're going to come back and knowing all the little cool little things that you're planning early on, they're going to come back. It's almost like The Usual Suspects, which I was watching the other night. It's like Verbal Kent telling the story and you got all the pieces that he's just putting together and just kind of throwing together and having them all laced throughout the stories you're telling, even though, you know, the payoff's not going to be for a while. Like, it's just fun.
Mm-hmm. It's great to read, I have to tell you. I really enjoy that.
Thank you.
We got to move into Superman Beyond, which is your next project, which
yes.
I'm a big Batman Beyond fan. I remember when the show started up, I was thinking, oh, no, this is going to be really awful. Never going to like it. And then when it hit, I was just hooked. And I just loved the whole business of the characters. And when they introduced the Justice League on the animated series, I was very intrigued by it. Did you like the show? I mean, did you watch it when it came on?
I watched it a little bit. Seems like I don't have as much time to watch television as other people. I just don't. The show is really good. And I've really been enjoying what Adam Beechin's done. They actually had a Batman Beyond book before the New 52 that he did. And I think he got up to issue like 6 or 8 before it got clipped because of the New 52. And I'm glad to see it's coming back. It's a fun book. These books are kind of fun because they're the characters we all know, but we get to play with stuff in a little different way. And the Superman story is the same way. Like, it's Superman, it's Kal-El, it's Clark Kent, the iconic characters there. But because of the setting and circumstances, you get to do things that you couldn't normally do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I got a kick. I was reading an interview you did with Newsarama about the fact that Superman doesn't have many people to interact with. The only one he has is Bruce, and you know, how much fun is Bruce to talk with?
Right.
I got a kick out of that when you said that. It made me laugh, because I'm a big Batman fan. I agree. The last thing I want to do is sit around and talk to Bruce Wayne. That would depress anybody, I think. So I found that kind of funny.
Yeah, it'd be a heavy conversation. Like, you're not going to have a light beer with him, you know, just kind of shoot the shit. You know, it's going to be like, seriously, can you stop talking about your parents for 1 minute and the Joker and stop looking around for crime, okay, for 1 second. Just relax.
Now, from my understanding, Superman 1000 is a very different place than we're used to him. In Metropolis, Lois Lane, Jimmy Olsen, Planet, all these kinds of things now are all basically gone, and he's having to rebuild his whole life, sounds like.
Yeah. It's funny. I mean, for me, Superman has a problem letting go of the past because he's always been clinging to what little past he could gather. You know, he lost his home world when he was a baby. And so anything Kryptonian, he holds dear and he tries to preserve in that museum of the Fortress of Solitude, these relics of the dead planet of Krypton. And so I kind of play on that in the sense that he's doing the same thing with the Metropolis he used to know, because the Metropolis he used to know is gone. And so he's trying to preserve that image, like maybe somebody would in the United States who was frustrated or whatever, seeing like the decay of our country and just pining away for like a time when the world was in a better place, whatever you want to call it, where simpler or easier, happier times for people. Granted that they weren't happier for everybody, and that's one of the things that clouds our vision a little bit in the terms of when we get to nostalgia like that, we only remember the good things. But I mean, for Kal-El, like, that's the thing, is like he doesn't have that world anymore, and so he's clinging to that past, but there's no connection there anymore because everybody he's known and everybody he was close to has passed away. So once you take away things like Lois Lane and the Daily Planet and his connection to Metropolis and his parents and everything else, what really does he have anymore? You know, what connection does he have to Metropolis or the world for that matter? And then you couple that with a sense in a world of the future where they've got police officers that have cybernetic technology that can give them advances that can mimic to a certain extent the abilities that Superman has. What purpose does he serve anymore when he's not needed? When, you know, if someone else can save the bus from going over the bridge and he doesn't have to do it anymore, where does he fit in? If he's not Clark Kent anymore, he's not Kal-El, and he's not Superman anymore. And it even goes to show, like, the costume he has. I mean, the costume he even wears, it's almost like it's designed to remove him from the world because it's not even the same Superman costume he wore that everybody's familiar with. It's some other costume that people could see him and be like, who is that? Whereas if he wore the red and blue, it'd be like, oh, that's Superman, obviously.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like a black and white. He sees things in black and white. In some senses. Now, as far as who is he going to be up against, are you going to like mix some of the standard Superman foes and move them into the future? Are you going to have new villains? I guess a mix would be the thing that I would think you'd want to do.
Yeah, the villains are definitely going to be a little bit of a mix. Lex Luthor's dead, which is unfortunate because he's obviously one of the biggies in Superman's world, and that's unfortunate. But we have a really cool idea for like the first villain that we're introducing, and you're going to see some familiar faces, but there's going to be some new stuff as well. It's a very big story in terms of the thready faces and the danger that's in store for him. I think it cuts to the heart of Superman and tells a very universal kind of Superman story for kind of fitting in with everything that he's about.
I'm looking forward to it because Superman seems to be a difficult character to write these days. I guess after all these decades and people have kind of, he's married, he's not, he's got Lex Luthor against him, he's got Brainiac against him. People are kind of feeling like he's very righteous versus somebody who is godlike in his abilities. And yet, and on the other hand, a sand creature takes away half of his power and stuff like that. So it seems like Superman's a real challenge. It sounds to me like you have an idea where you want to go with him, though. So I like that.
Yeah, it is a tricky character. You know, talking about the flaws of the character that I like to write, his flaws are very minor, if there are any. I mean, he is kind of the Boy Scout. He never struggles with making the right decision. He always knows what the right thing to do is. He never wavers in that. His compass, his moral compass is rock solid. It's infallible. He always does the right thing. That's why he represents the best in humanity. It's not because of the powers he has. He's not Superman, and he doesn't represent the best in us because he can fly, and he's really strong, and he's indestructible. It's because he has a strong sense of self and a strong sense of justice and honor and what's right and wrong in the world. That's why I think Superman stands the test of time. And that's what I think always remains with him. And that's why the world would always need a Superman, even if there are other people with abilities similar to his, even if he's not as strong as he used to be, even if he has moved himself a little bit from this world. People will always need someone to be the voice of reason, the voice of the right, the voice of justice and honor in this world. And so that's always going to be him. But that does provide for a tricky scenario in trying to write a character and bring the drama and the conflict to his life in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Now, as far as when Superman Beyond actually starts, my understanding is Batman Beyond Unlimited starts with number one. Superman Beyond doesn't actually begin to appear until issue number three.
Yeah, it's part of the digital release plan for the Beyond universe. And so the book will actually be released digitally first in 10-page chapters. I still wrote them as 20-page books, but they'll be released in 10-page chapters. And then they'll come out periodically in the print comic, the Batman Beyond Unlimited. So in that Batman Beyond Unlimited number three, I'm actually not sure if it's the first 20 pages, the first full issue, or if it's just the first 10 that's coming out in print. But I kind of like that they're making the Batman Beyond Unlimited book kind of a Beyond Universe anthology book. Like it's kind of neat kind of putting them all together like that to kind of make it feel like we're building this universe out together.
I like to call it the Beyondiverse.
The Beyondiverse. I like that. Yeah.
Now, when the pages come out on digitally, you have to buy them. How does this work that you access them?
It's just buying them like you would the standard, like day and date digital stuff. I'm not sure what the price is going to be because it's only 10 pages. I don't know if it's $1.99 or 99 cents or how they're doing it, but you'd use your digital comic app, you know, your Comixology, your Graphically, your DC app itself to download the comic to enjoy it that way.
Mm-hmm. Now, it starts in issue three. Is this ongoing? Is this going to be like a definite number of issues?
Well, right now, it's 5 issues. I think we're going to have to wait and see how the whole initiative does to see if there'll be more. I hope it does well and that there'll be more because I'm having a lot of fun working with the character and Howard Porter is doing the art on it and he's been really fun to work with. I've been wanting to work with him for a while. I mean, I've known of his work and we've met a few times over the years, and so getting a chance to work with him has been really fun. So I would love to write more. They'll have it.
Sounds great. Now, other projects you're working on you want to talk with us about? Well, it sounds like this should be keeping you busy for a while.
Yeah. I'm still working with Aspen. They're kind of a home for me. Like I said earlier, like they were the reason that I have a career in comic books is because of them, because they took a chance on me. Mike and Frank did, and you know, all those years ago, writing Fathom and then helping out with Soulfire. We're just wrapping up. Next week, Soulfire 7 comes out from Volume 3, and there's one more issue to that. Issue 8 will end Volume 3. And then we have a summer event coming up called The Search for the Light, which is a 5 one-issue stories, one-shot issues that tie thematically together. And I'm actually writing 2 of those. And then that all leads into the 4th volume of Soulfire. So I've been writing Soulfire, I think, longer than I've been writing any other book in my career. I started on issue 3 in volume 1. So I wrote most of volume 1, all of volume 2, Dying of the Light miniseries, a Chaos Reign miniseries, a New World Order miniseries, some one-shots here and there. It's just been the one that I think I've been with the longest. And it's just a real gratifying book to work on. It's a fun, exciting book, kind of this futuristic world of magic. And it's been really great. So I have that. And then I have my Mindfield miniseries with the first volume with Aspen's. I'm hopefully going to get collected into the trade later this year. I'm writing my first novel, which I'm hoping to release later this year as well. So, which is definitely different for me, but something I've been working on for a long time. To the extent that you know, as a creator, you can have a quote baby. This is my baby. So, I'm just it's just something I'm wanting to do for a long time. And I got 2 kids, and I just want to write something that my kids can read, because everything I seem to write, my kids can't read, because they can't really give them Rise of Arsenal. So, so I'm really excited about that. It's been something I'm working on for a long time, and I'm really excited to get that out there and share it with people. I'm looking forward to that. And I've also got DC. I'm doing The War That Time Forgot in the pages of the GI Combat that starts in May. So I'm trying to keep busy.
Man, that's great. I know that when I see your name on a book, I'm going to get a good story. So I'm always there when I see it. So keep up the great work.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
That's good talking with you, JT, and hopefully we get to talk with you again. Maybe when your novel comes out, we'll have a chance to talk about that.
I'd love that. That'd be great.
Okay, thanks so much.
Thank you, Wayne.
Faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound. Look, up in the sky, it's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's Wayne's Comic Review.
Strange visitor from another planet who came to Earth with powers and abilities far beyond those of mortal men. Who can change the course of mighty rivers, bend steel in his bare hands. And now, another exciting episode.
And here's what I thought of this week's comics. The book of the week for me was Joe Hill's The Cape from IDW. It was a 4-issue miniseries, and it wrapped up this week. Wow, is that an interesting story. We all like to think that if we were given superpowers, we'd act like Superman, righteous and conscientious and uplifting, just like J.T. Kroll talked about. But what would happen if we didn't end up that way? What would happen if we went the way of Darkseid instead? When he was a kid, Eric played the villain while his friend Nikki portrayed the hero. Both were very good at their roles. Now we flash forward several years, and Eric discovers that he has a cape that allows him to fly. The interesting thing is, he starts doing really terrible things to people. It turns out that he has to face his one-time foe, Nikki, again, and the confrontation's quite an interesting one. I was very surprised by how it all ended, and there could be more to come. So that was a good book for me. I'm sure this is coming out in a hardcover. In fact, I've seen it solicited. So I think you're going to get Joe Hill's The Cape. He's also the guy behind Lock and Key, which is another terrific comic. There's only one DC comic that came out as part of the New 52, and that was Justice League number 6. Jim Lee, of course, provides the art and the stories by Geoff Johns. We get to see Darkseid's introduction to the Justice League as a villain, and it's about the members meeting each other and working together. As much as I have enjoyed the comic, I still think an issue or two could have been removed. It could have been 4 instead of 6 issues, but these days we have trade paperbackitis, so this was a really good, strong conclusion, though, so it was definitely worth the picking up. You also get a backup story with Pandora, the mysterious woman in a red cloak that we'd seen previously. She speaks with the Phantom Stranger, and they talk about what's obviously going to be a future plotline in Justice League, so don't miss this book. Other comics that came out included Batman Odyssey Volume 2, Number 5 of 7, DC Universe Online Legends Number 24, and Thunder Agents Volume 2, Number 4 of 6 from DC Comics. Venom Number 13.4 from Marvel, the fun book Steed and Mrs. Peel Number 2 of 6 from Boom, Invincible Number 89, the Samurai's Blood Trade paperback, and The Walking Dead Number 94 from Image. As well as Green Hornet number 22, Kevin Smith's Bionic Man number 7, and the not-to-be-missed Lord of the Jungle number 2 from Dynamite. And those are the comics that came out this week.
Okay, I want to welcome back to the podcast Pete Casaza from Big Planet Comics in College Park, Maryland. How are you doing today, Pete?
Pretty good. It's nice weather.
Yeah, for a change. It's getting better, yeah. Thankfully.
Yes.
So, February. How did February do in your store?
Pretty well, actually. February is a short month, and there's usually not a lot of good books that come out, so it's never one of our strongest months. But this February, the 29th, fell on a Wednesday, which certainly helped. And it was pretty strong, actually. Overall, I'm pretty positive. So far, 2012 has gotten off to a very nice start.
Right. So February this year was better than last year?
Oh, definitely, yeah. There are a lot more good books coming out. Last February, there was really very little material out. And the new DC 52, I know I talk about that a lot, but I'm still seeing a lot of action on that. And people are definitely coming in and trying new titles still. So that's still helping us out.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. Any books that continue on to be the bestsellers?
The usual Justice League, Batman. Batman's kind of reached a critical mass lately. Everybody's really excited about this big Owl crossover, the Night of the Owl, or whatever they're calling it. Really seems like it's going to be something people are really going to jump onto.
Now, as far as the canceled books, have you noticed that the sales have dropped off on the ones that they've announced that have been canceled?
A little bit. People are reluctant to try them at this point. They know they're going to be canceled. And they're, there's only got two more issues yet. Left, so I might as well not even buy number 6 or 7, so since it's ending. So, yeah, there's been a little bit of a slowdown, but a few people are like, I don't care, I just want to try it anyway, just to see what it's like. Maybe I'll buy the trade when it comes out. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's a mixed bag, but definitely, yeah, they're being canceled because they weren't doing that well to begin with, and announcing a cancellation certainly has increased sales, that's for sure.
Okay, as far as Animal Man and things like that, they're still doing well?
Swamp Thing, Animal Man, still performing above. All-Star Western's another one that stood out. People discovered later and more recently, but they're really liking what they read, so that's it's been really good for us, too.
That's good. A little variety is never a bad thing, so I think
that's right.
How about Marvel? Are Ultimate Spider-Man still selling very well?
Still doing very well for us. It's still one of their best sellers. The relaunch of the X-Men is still doing very well, especially Uncanny and Wolverine and the X-Men. Those two titles are doing very well. And this Avengers vs. X-Men, this is going to be enormous. This is going to be really, really huge.
Mm-hmm. How do you think it'll do compared to the New 52?
Well, it's only one main title and some small titles or two titles, so it's not a huge 52 brand new titles. So, but as a single issue, I think it'll become our bestseller. I think it'll probably beat out Justice League and Batman, or at least have a good chance to.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I'm expecting high things from this.
Okay, now, as far as the party, are you guys going to open up that night to...
Yes. We're going to, I was shocked when I heard Marvel announced that 1,100 stores or thereabouts had agreed to do this. That's tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
Opening at Tuesday at 8 p.m. is a lot better than opening at midnight. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of stores are really see, and it's a great project, and I think a lot of people are going to be really excited to be the first ones there.
Are you guys going to serve food during that, or just basically?
Yeah, we might have some cupcakes and cookies and some drinks and stuff like that. Just a little something to have a good time and whatever. The people talk and hang out for a while.
Mm-hmm. How late do you figure you'll be open?
Probably over an hour, hour and a half. Depends on the crowd. People are still hanging around. We don't want to be there all night, but certainly if people are coming in and having a good time, we're going to stay open.
Okay. And basically the book you'll be selling will be Avengers vs. X-Men 1.
Yeah, that's the only one that's the only new book we'll be allowed to sell.
But you'll be selling other stuff. People want to pick up
a lot of, Marvel and Avengers trades and collections and, everything that's from the previous couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. We'll certainly have. But, the only new book we'll be allowed to sell is Avengers vs. X-Men.
And what day is that going to be again?
That's April 3rd. Tuesday, April 3rd, starting at 8 p.m.
Okay, so we can look forward to that.
I think there's going to be a lot of press about it, and I think there's just going to be a lot of coverage. It seems to be that ABC News is going to cover this because, they're owned by Disney, which owns Marvel, so it seems like they're going to definitely be on this to a certain degree.
Mm-hmm. Now, you'll be open your regular time the next day as well?
Yeah, our regular hours, 11 to 8 on Wednesday.
Okay. Are you seeing an uptick in the Avengers and X-Men book as we get closer to it?
Certainly a lot more interest. A lot of people are coming in and asking questions about it and wanting to know more about it and what should they read before and what's leading up to it. Definitely is increasing a lot of interest. So.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause I noticed that they got them clearly labeled on the covers that this is like a prelude to Avengers versus X-Men.
Yeah, it hasn't really started yet. They're advertising that, but the main storyline hasn't started yet. But they're trying to get people to look into it now.
To go back a little bit, how are the trades doing as far as like February goes?
Pretty well. Better, I guess. It's still mostly comics. Most of our sales are really good sales results are in comic books. But trade books aren't bad. I'm not complaining. Like I said, this February is much better than last February, so any increase is good.
That's right. Now, as far as other comics go, other companies, Image and stuff, how's The Walking Dead selling for you with the TV show?
It's tremendous. It's funny because it's a good seller for us all the time, but it's really funny to watch sales spike every time there's new episodes on television. It's kind of hysterical. Now, last week we sold like 5 or 6 copies of the first volume of The Walking Dead. And that's a lot to sell in 1 week.
Wow.
We usually sell a couple, but to see 5 or 6 go out in 1 week is pretty impressive.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting because the show is different from the comic on several levels. So it must be fun for people to go back and see what was done originally.
Yeah, I'm wondering if that's helping to drive interest in the trades, too, because word's gotten out that the comic isn't exactly the same. So people who have read the comic are interested and annoyed but happy. They get something new to see, but they're like, oh, they changed it. Oh, what's wrong with that? Why would they do that? And for people who don't know the comic, it's like, well, maybe I should go read the comic if it's got different elements in it and see what the difference is so I can be part of the conversation. If you think about it, this is probably the best thing that ever happened in comics in the sense that there's millions of people watching the show, and there's no way there's millions of people buying the comic yet.
Mm-hmm.
But there could be a big-time crossover between these people, especially since the TV series is so good, it's continuing on so long, and the comic is so good, and it's been continuing on for such a while that there's a lot for people to buy.
Mm-hmm. And some people are saying that there ought to be commercials for the comics during the show when it airs. And yet some people are saying that the whole show is a commercial for the comics.
It is, really. I agree with that. I think it really does. If people are interested in reading more, they're really into the series, then it definitely drives people to go to the comic book locator service or check the internet to find out where their local comic store is. There's no question that it's driving at least some traffic to the store.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you a couple of questions about some other stuff that's going on that kind of interests me. This Archie Comics, they've been doing more socially relevant stuff, like the gay marriage issue, and there's an upcoming Occupy Riverdale. Have you seen an impact as far as the sales go?
Not really. The biggest impact we first had with Archie was when they did the future issues where he married Veronica, and then he married Betty, you know, kind of what-if future tales. Mm-hmm. Those drove a tremendous amount of traffic to the stores for a while. And there's still sales of Archie have stayed higher than average because of that. They're doing this Life with Archie book that's pretty interesting. And the Kevin Kellner stuff, that hasn't done a lot for us, but it's definitely sold. Definitely driven more interest than just not doing anything like this. So, yeah, overall, I'm pretty positive about these things. People still come in and go, oh, my God, they still make Archie comics? I didn't realize they were still doing new ones. My grandmother read these, you know, and daughters and grandmothers. Daughters and, you know, children today have all, you know, it's a running line that they've all read about, and it kind of connects all the generations, so it's pretty neat.
Mm-hmm. Now, I read a story recently on the ComicsAlliance.com where they were talking about a young girl who got her father to read comics because she was interested in Batman, and when they went to a comic store, there was a lady at the counter who was able to direct them to age-specific comics like Tiny Titans and things like that. How are your children's or younger readers' lines doing? Are they selling pretty well?
They are. I mean, they've never been a huge seller, but they've been growing steadily over the last couple of years, which is really encouraging. It's kind of one of the few bright spots through the economic downturn we've had a few years is that children's sales have been strong or getting stronger, especially we've driven like books like Bone. Once Scholastic took over Bone, they really got it into a lot of schools and a lot of kids got exposed to it. And it's led them to discovering other books like Amulet and other children's books. And, of course, Archie and Dragon Ball Z. And even though it's not exactly a children's book, it's very popular with children. Sonic, any of these video game characters are very popular with kids and even some young adults. And it's really it's a great gateway to reading and discovering comics and the variety of comics. One of the things that's so frustrating is so many Americans feel that, A, comics are only for kids and that they're all about superheroes. And to show kids and adults, like Walking Dead is doing, that comics aren't just for kids, certainly, and there's more than just superhero comics out there is really a good thing.
Well, Kaboom recently has launched Peanuts and Adventure Time, and Garfield's coming as well. Have you been selling Adventure Time there?
I wish we could, but we got 10 issues, and they sold out in the first 10 minutes or so. We got them. We're getting a whole bunch more this week. Yeah, it's a really funky, cool cartoon that appeals to kids and adults. It's kind of wacky, and the comic seems to have just that kind of appeal. It's something so offbeat that it really crosses over and really becomes kind of, you know, hip, super neat thing to have and show your friends.
Mm-hmm.
So we're expecting big things from the Adventure Time comic.
Okay, and Garfield, of course, is well-known.
Well-known, and having a comic with Garfield, I think. Garfield books are never anything that I really carried because they're in so many bookstores, they're kind of everywhere. Mm-hmm. But having a Garfield comic, I think, might do something well for us.
Mm-hmm. And it's a Peanuts miniseries. Has that done very well? Or
it's been okay. I was thinking it would have done a little better, but it's done fine. It didn't do quite as well as Disney books. Boom Studios was publishing Disney for a while before they bought Marvel. Mm-hmm. And they were hoping Peanuts would do just as well. It hasn't, for us anyway, hasn't done quite as well, but it's still a good seller.
Mm-hmm. Now, they're about to come out with Toy Story from Marvel.
Yes, when Marvel does launch all these Disney and Pixar books, those tend to do very well for us. Incredibles and Toy Story were two of our best sellers for kids' mm-hmm. books. Mm-hmm. And it's been tough the last year not really having any of that stuff to sell mm-hmm. to kids. Mm-hmm. Looking forward to that.
I hope that Marvel will do more of those. Once they get a property, sometimes they send a sit on these things. One of the credits I'll give to Kaboom was that, or Boom Kids, was that they did put out a lot of product, which was, you know, great fun. I love those shows like Darkwing Duck and things like that, so I bought those comics.
Yeah, those were really fun and great sellers. And, yeah, the real shift between Disney and Marvel is still kind of working its way out, and there's certainly a lot more Disney and Marvel could be doing together to reach out to kids. So hopefully they'll get that worked out, and hopefully these Toy Story comics and the other ones will do very well, and that'll encourage them to do a lot more on a very regular basis.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good. Anything else that you want to say about February or looking forward?
I'm really looking forward to the spring. I feel like this March and April, as I mentioned, April 3rd will be the launch of the X-Men versus Avengers. And I think the stuff leading up to there for DC and Marvel, and just a lot of good summer books coming, I think. So I'm really looking forward to having a really good year. Last 2 years have been pretty tough on the comics industry, and I'm really hoping this is the year that launches us all back into full strength.
Okay, cool. So why don't you give your address and your podcast and other information like that?
Well, our store name is Big Planet Comics, and you can find us on the web at bigplanetcomics.com. We also have a podcast we do every week, or just about every week. You can find at our website or on Apple iTunes Store. You can download Big Planet Comics podcast. And my store, the one I work at, is Big Planet Comics in College Park, Maryland. It's 7315 Baltimore Avenue, and the phone number is 301-699-0498.
Pete, thanks a lot. We'll talk with you again and see how March did next month.
Absolutely, Wayne. It's always good to talk to you.
No, same here. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Okay, it's time for this week's news and previews, and with me this week, as always, is Ian Cullen. How are you, Ian?
I'm very well, thank you.
And you, Gianluca Glazer, how are you?
I'm doing well.
Okay, this week, why don't we go ahead and start with you, Gianluca. What kind of news have you got for us this week?
Sure. San Diego Comic-Con 2012 tickets sold out in less than 2 hours.
Oof.
That's the big news, because that's happening as we're doing this recording, so... But it's old news by the time people hear it. But that's what happened. If you wanted to get tickets, you had to be quick. I guess anybody who logged in at 8:30 Pacific Standard Time or later didn't get tickets. So.
Yeah. Were these the full...
eBay.
Oh, yeah. If you go on eBay and get those. Were these the full four-day tickets, or were these only the individual days, or what tickets sold out?
For regular attendees, everything. 4 days with preview, 4 days without preview, and all the single days all sold out within a matter of 2 hours.
Wow. Okay.
Pro registration and press registration is still to happen, but anybody who gets rejected on either one of those won't have regular attendees to fall back on.
Interesting. You're planning to go, right?
I didn't get tickets. Last year, I bought tickets, and then they were a waste of money because Ben Arroyo ended up bringing me on and giving me an exhibitor badge. Mm-hmm. But I ended up maybe using, like, the one I got from my wife on Sunday. But with this year, you had to get a member ID before you registered. If you didn't do that by the end of February, you couldn't even register on that Saturday morning that they went online.
Wow.
I didn't get a member number for, like, a friend of mine or for my wife or anything, so I technically could have only bought one badge. Mm-hmm. But if you do know people who do have member IDs, you could have gotten them their badge.
Mm-hmm.
But only one member ID could be used once, so... Wayne, were you able to get a press badge last year?
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to try to maybe get a press badge through Sci-Fi Pulse. Otherwise, unlike last year, it's just not like a case where I could just go for fun. Have to get a hotel room or a place to stay at and just basically take a vacation, you know? Mm-hmm. It's not a luxury I could afford to do like I could last year.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe what we'll have to do is some of us will have to bunk in together and work all this stuff out and see if we can do that. I'd like to be closer than I was. I mean, I appreciated the place I was last year. Mm-hmm. But holy smoke, that was quite a travel. And then, of course, when you get there, you got to do all this walking all over the place. I'm still recovering from that. I got to get in better shape for this year. I just do. I lose a little weight and get some action, you know, get some activity going so I can survive this time.
Yeah, I'll see if I can get you some action, Wayne. What sort do you want?
Oh, no, not that kind of action. No. You know what kind of action you get, and although I don't know very well, I probably ought to pass on that. But anyway, any other news? Why don't we hurriedly go on to other news? Any other news?
Sure, absolutely. Valiant Comics is making a lot of news lately. They are going to be doing 4 books in the summer. Bloodshot is going to be one of them. They announced that there's going to be a film adaptation of that. The new previews has a Harbinger ongoing series with Joshua Dysart and Kari Evans working on it. And also, there's an X-O Man of War that's coming out. Actually, that's the one that's in the new previews. Harbinger was just announced online, but X-O Man of War's in previews. They got a talking variant cover by Helena Kevik-Durjevic, and they're kind of hinting maybe that like their 4th title is going to be Shadow Man, but there hasn't been an official announcement.
Did either of you guys ever read any of those books? Because I actually read X-O Man of War when it first came out, as well as Harbinger, so I'm kind of looking forward to those. Those were great fun. I like those books a lot. I was very disappointed when Valiant went under, because it seemed like Mr. What's his name? Can't think of his name right now. Jim Shooter, yeah. When Mr. Shooter gets a hold of something, it starts out with great fanfare, and then it kind of waters down and fades out after a little while. So I would really like to see him get to do some more of those. I thought his Dr. Solar and Magnus Robot Fighter were pretty good, but once again, they sort of seemed to peter out, and I was really sorry about that over at Dark Horse. Maybe he just wasn't really interested once he discovered he could do Valiant again.
I don't know if he's involved in the new Valiant. I don't think he is.
Something we got to find out about, because I'm fascinated to find that out.
Yeah. In other news for Marvel, Jonathan Hickman is leaving Fantastic Four. We announced last week about Bendis leaving the Avengers to do the X-Men books. So Hickman kind of hints that something big is coming up for him. So.
Well, he's doing other books for over at Image.
He is.
Been, like 2 of them, at least I know of. So maybe he's getting other work and he's decided he wants to go the creator-owned route. He probably gets more money out of it than he does writing Fantastic Four. Now, what is he writing FF, do you know? Is he only leaving Fantastic Four and staying on FF? What's the story with that?
Let's see. He's got a book called Manhattan Projects that's coming out next week.
Right.
March 7th.
Sounds like it's about nuking a bomb.
I believe he has another series after that that's coming out. So
I'd be curious if he's going to stay on FF and drop Fantastic Four. Fantastic Four is the one that's likely to sell better than FF, especially since now the quote-unquote Fantastic Four are over on their own title again. I'd be curious to see what will happen with that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay.
All right. The controversial Life of Archie number 16 sold out this week. That was the book that featured the gay wedding on the cover, and it was the one that got a million moms group to protest and try to get Toys R Us to drop this particular issue. So.
Oh, dear.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's something like that you don't have to deal with in the UK, I imagine.
So a million homophobic moms, huh?
Yes. Basically, the punchline with them, yeah.
I'm surprised there's that many homophobic bums in the U.S., you know, but there you go.
Yeah, and the new March previews came out, and here's just a quick rundown of stuff that appealed to me, popped out at me. For DC, they have Batman Incorporated number 1 with Grant Morrison and Chris Burnham. Rob Liefeld starts co-writing The Hawkman number 9, The Savage Hawkman, and does the cover for that, which doesn't do a bad job. Actually, a good-looking cover for once. Raphael Albuquerque is doing art on a backup story of Batman number 9. This and Detective are both going up a dollar, but they're including backup stories in it. So I can't wait for this particular thing.
Court of the Owl stuff, yeah.
Yes. But, so Raphael Albuquerque is going to be doing a backup for Batman 9. Mm-hmm. Batman Annual number 1 solicited with Scott Snyder and Jay Fabok. It's got Mr. Freeze in it. Animal Man number 9 has Steve Pugh working full time on it.
Yay!
Yay! And then there's an Animal Man annual as well with Jeff Lemire writing it. You got artwork by Timothy Green and Joseph Silver. Mm-hmm. All Star Western number 9 has a really cool looking cover. You got to check it out. It's by Landrun with two N's at the end, and it is a Night of the Owls tie-in. The Night of Owls storyline going on with the Court of Owls. Hardcovers, there's a Batman and Robin hardcover and a Batgirl hardcover for the first 4 or 5 issues. And then the trade paperback treatment goes to Red Lantern, Frankenstein, Agent of Shade, Static Shock, Legion of Superheroes, and Mr. Terrific. Over on IDW, we have Frankenstein Alive. It's said twice. It's number 1, and it's by Steve Niles and Bernie Wrightson. It's in black and white, but they do a color scan of Bernie's black and white artwork, so there's layers of shade and stuff. Doesn't say how many issues it's going to be. Another new artist edition from IDW. This time it's David Mazzucchelli's Daredevil Reborn Again. Mm-hmm. Rocketeer Adventures Volume 2, Number 3 has a really cool looking cover by Darwin Cook. Just want to point that out. Dynamite has Dinosaurs and Aliens with Grant Morrison and Barry Sonnenfeld. They also have another noir classic character called the Spider. Maybe not as well known to us today as Shadow is, but he was pretty popular in his day.
I've been seeing the Shadow. He's all over. I was reading Flash Gordon just before we came on the air. Flash Gordon Zeitgeist.
Zeitgeist.
And it's sort of like a double page spread of the Shadow.
Oh.
Like a... I would say no, it's coming out sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Cool.
So, yeah, they're getting all the pulp characters, so that's the newest one. David Liss, he's the writer for that. He's a best-selling regular prose author, usually does historical fiction, so probably a good choice for something like this that might take place back in the 30s. Boom Studios has new books, Higher Earth number 1 with Sam Humphries. This is the second book Sam Humphries is doing with Boom, and he's kind of a hot property right now. Garfield, I told you guys about it last week. It's in previews. Mark Evanier is writer for that. He did the television series. And Gary Barker is doing the artwork. Also, just in case you didn't know, Wayne, the solicited Irredeemable and Incorruptibles, it's the last issue for both series.
Yeah, I heard that. I'm very sorry to hear that. I liked both of those books, but I can understand it. It seems like he's kind of running out of ideas of what to continue on with, at least for now. So, unfortunately, that'll be two less. I don't know if it's two fewer or two less. I'll be buying two less Mark Waid books coming up really quickly.
Yeah, hopefully they can make up for it with Sam Humphries and his two new series.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Sales. But, I mean, that's how Boom is. It's resilient. It keeps coming up with new properties when old ones have to eventually retire or move somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And then Valiant, like I mentioned before, they took a really big 6-page ad spread in previews. Mm-hmm. So, Exo Man of War, Robert Venditti, he's another best-selling prose, New York Times best-selling author, doing this. And then you have Eisner, I think he's nominated, I don't know if he's won, but Conan artist Kerry Nord is doing the artwork for X-O Man of War.
Okay.
Robert Venditti, is it Venditti or?
I-T-T-I, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if that is the same guy that did a trade paperback a few years back and it was made into a Bruce Willis movie.
Never know.
Interesting.
I can't remember what it's called, but I did read it. Read the trade paperback before I've seen the movie. But I can't remember what it's called.
Okay. The one other thing I want to mention in the previews, Vic Boone, the trade paperback, is coming out. It's a collection of the first several issues. It's under 215 ink. It's under the T's for the 2, I guess, instead of being... I wish they'd put it in the front because of the number. But it's 215 ink. It's Vic Boone. It's done by Sean Aldridge. And I really like that story. If you want to read a fun and very different kind of comic, I would say get the trade paperback for Vic Boone.
Mm.
Okay, Ian.
Well, I've got a little bit of news before I go on to my previews.
Okay.
Yeah, sure.
On the front of something that that wasn't mentioned, and this will probably be happening the day after this show goes out, so this is kind of like a last-minute heads-up, really, for when the show goes out on Monday. But Meltdown Comics are doing an event on the 7th. It starts at 6 p.m.
Oh, yeah.
Jeff Kahn's going to be there, and it's going to be launch of Red Spike Volume 1 trade paperback, right?
Yes, it is. The trade paperback collecting issues 1 through 5.
So that's something that you forgot to mention that I thought I'd get in there because the show airs before that happens.
Ah, cool. Awesome. Yes, there'll be free booze. Like, if you live in Los Angeles and you want, we'll be giving out free first issue comics. So get some comics. You can get a nice vodka Red Bull mix, your own kind of Red Spike.
Cool. And sad news, actually, this was posted on Sci-Fi Pulse. Comic book legend Sheldon Moldar passed away, and he's one of the last titans of the golden age of comic books. It seems to all be going of late. But he wrote Odds and Ends, which was his first professional job, and that was a backup strip for the cover of the legendary Action Comics number one. He also did the artwork for Hawkman, and he was one of Bob Kane's ghost artists on Batman. Added to that, he was a cover artist for the first appearance of Green Lantern and The Flash. He was also the co-creator of Poison Ivy and Mr. Freeze, among many characters. So that's quite a big loss to comics.
The interesting thing is that he was well known for writing or drawing Green Lanterns. I saw him at several conventions, and he was very much, you know, trying to sell his artwork for Green Lantern. And I'm really sorry to see him pass because he was a great guy. He was a lot of fun to do stuff with and to talk with. Very, you know, interested in the fans, very interested in the industry. And one of the hard workers, you know, he grew up in that era and participated in the era when it was very, very difficult to get work. So whenever they gave him something, he did it and turned it around in a hurry. Okay, so now let's see, that's the news. Ian, sounds like you're ready to talk about your previews.
Well, you know, we've got Action Comics issue 7 coming out this week, along with Detective Comics issue 7. There's the Action Comics combo pack, which is basically a digital copy as well. Mm-hmm. We have Animal Man coming out this week. Mm-hmm. We also have issue 7 of Stormwatch, which is due out this week. So those are all goodies that are coming from DC, although, as you guys know, I'm kind of going off Action.
Yeah.
You know? Current storyline. If it don't pick up after this one, I'm going to drop it because it's probably one of the most expensive comics on my pull list.
Mm.
And if I'm not enjoying it, I'm not going to buy it.
Okay.
Alright.
Any other things?
Oh, for the Star Wars fans, it's Star Wars Clone Wars trade paperback, Volume 7, Enemy Within. And you got Star Wars Crimson Empire 3, Empire Lost, Issue 5 of 6, which is coming out.
Right.
And those are released through Dark Horse Comics.
Okay.
And for the Doctor Who fans, Doctor Who Classics series, issue 2 of 6 comes out, and I think that's actually volume 4, and the Doctor Who Ongoing 2 trade paperback, volume 3.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I could go on, but I've got to leave something for you guys.
Okay, all right. Well, all right, Gianluca, how about you?
Yeah, there's some interesting stuff coming out. Ian already mentioned an Animal Man number 7. There's also going to be a Detective Comics number 7 and a Swamp Thing number 7 coming out. IDW has some interesting stuff. We mentioned Jonathan Hickman earlier. Yeah, Manhattan Projects number 1 comes out March 7th. And that deals with the atomic bomb creation being kind of a cover-up for some more interesting experiments that actually went on during that time. So, interesting concept. Two great trade paperbacks coming out. Red Spike Volume 1 trade paperback. Mm-hmm. Like I said, if you're in L.A., definitely come by Meltdown Comics at 6 o'clock. Also, The Vault Volume 1 trade paperback goes on sale as well. And that's a really good series there. I believe Sam Sakaar has talked with you, hasn't he?
I think it was me that did Sam Sakaar.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It's like John Carpenter's The Thing meets James Cameron's The Abyss. Interesting stuff. Marvel is coming out with a Toy Story number 1. It's going to be a first of a 4-issue miniseries. So they're finally releasing a Pixar title. Dreamweavers number 4.
Oh, goody.
That's coming out. Boom has Superbia number 1, which is kind of a superhero mixed with the Real Housewives of whatever city.
Mm-hmm.
And then Valen the Outcast number 4, also by Boom Studios, comes out.
You know, that Superbia has already sold out number 1. I understand. So that's good for them. Always glad when a Boom book sells out. Kind of cool. Okay, let me run down a couple that interest me. Batwing number 7, continuing on. Green Arrow number 7, I think this is when Anna Sandy starts writing, so I'm going to be curious to see how that moves forward. Huntress number 6 of 6, that miniseries concludes. JLI number 7, of course all these are 7s. Men of War 7. OMAC, Red Lantern, Static Shock. The interesting 2 TV show related comics are out this week. That is Beyond the Fringe, what has to do with Fringe, and yeah. Supernatural, what has to do with Supernatural, interestingly enough. So those are both out from DC this week. week. So those are good ones. A couple of other ones I thought to throw in, Fatale number 3.
Oh, really? I missed that.
Yeah, Fatale number 3 is in there, so I want to make sure that gets in there. Avengers Academy number 27. I don't understand why they're making a miniseries of Toy Story, but Marvel's never one. Once they get a hold of something, never one to take chances with it, but oh well. And Adventure Time number 1, the second printing is out, which will be good news. A couple of other things really quickly that I like. Well, the Lone Ranger number 3, they rebooted that, and that's coming out. So that'll be kind of interesting. I sort of missed the original group that was doing it before. It's not nearly up to that level, but it's Lone Ranger. And then there's Rachel Rising number 6, which is a really off-center comic. I would highly recommend it. Speaking of Irredeemable, Irredeemable number 35 is out this week, so get your Irredeemables while they're being made. So anything else we should talk about before and we call this a quits?
And as a very, very, very quick last-minute side note, you know, as soon as you brought up the Lone Ranger, the new Johnny Depp movie, The Lone Ranger, has just started production. So it's going to happen, folks.
You know, what character does Johnny Depp not play? He seems to do just about every classic character out there. Between him and Robert Downey Jr., they do in every classic character possible, so.
Well, someone's got to do it, and you don't see any other actors stepping up to the roles, don't you? So.
That's true. That's true. Okay, and on that note, we'll call it to quits for another week of news and previews. Talk with you guys again next week.
Ooh.
And that's a wrap for this episode of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. I'm sure you're going to want to join me next time when I speak to Greg Hurwitz, accomplished novelist and writer of DC's Penguin, Pain and Prejudice, and who's also taking over the writing chores on Batman the Dark Knight. You'll enjoy what he has to say. Great conversation we had. So until next time, keep reading your comics.
End results aside, we are not happy. You hacked Justice League systems, disobeyed direct orders, and endangered lives. You will not be doing this again.
I am sorry, but we will.